Welcome to Ballers with Babies. I'm Mark Willard. Today we know so much about what athletes and sports personalities do, but not so much about who they are, what makes them tick. What's life like the moment the stadiums and TV cameras go dark? Most go home to their families. We want to know what that after-hours experience is like. Ballers with Babies explores their upbringing, their home life, how it's affected by their high-profile job, and how that high-profile job is affected by the home life. On Ballers with Babies, we talk to some of the most interesting names in sports and find out how they're even more interesting than we realized. And don't worry, diehard fan, we'll get to the important sports questions as well. This is your favorite people like you've never heard them before. I hope you enjoy. All right, let's get him in here. Author Jeff Perlman on Ballers with Babies. You, of course, know him for all the books. But I also know you, Jeff, as one of the only other parenting-related sports podcasters, at least in your past. You've got the two writers slinging yang now. You and your wife had the Sports Parent podcast, right? What was the take on that? What was the angle there?
Well, my wife is she has her own business called The Family Coach. She's a social work background where she would go into she goes into homes and she helps people with different parenting issues. So we decided we would take sort of my background in sports and her background in parenting, and we would sort of talk about sports and parenting and little league issues and, you know, misbehavior involving sports and when to sign your kids up for sports and all that stuff.
So there's plenty of content there, right? I mean, it's not even just that podcast. I mean, you've written articles on this, you can see it on your social media. Like where do you see that now based on where it was when you got started, the whole like little league parent thing, youth sports, travel ball, is it getting better or getting worse?
I think it's getting worse and worse and worse, actually. It's funny. I have kids. My daughter's a freshman in high school. My son is in sixth grade. And I used to think, I can't wait for them to do sports. And now I'm being serious. If my son said tomorrow, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do sports anymore, not only would I be supportive, I'd probably be a little happy. Because I'm just being honest, I'm brought up in sports, but I cannot stand the ruin. I mean, I have stories beyond stories from just my kids alone and the ruinous behavior of parents, emphasis of winning at all costs at in 11-year-old flag football games, you know, and on and on and on. So it brings me down in major ways.
What's the worst thing you observed? And was it like directly, affecting your family, or was it just something you happened across?
I probably have two that tie. Number one is, I think my son was 9 and a parent on his team started bringing a radar gun to clock pitches. And this was a nice parent. I mean, you know, and then the other is, my son played flag football 2 years ago. It's probably his favorite sport, flag football.
Yeah.
And he had an assistant coach who bragged to the kids about his time playing college football and then his time in the NFL with the Dallas Cowboys. And I wrote a book called Boys Will Be Boys about the Dallas Cowboys of the era he was speaking of.
Right.
And I'd never heard of this guy. So I actually ended up calling. I asked him one day. I was like, oh, where did you play college ball? And he told me. And I called the SID of the college. And he's like, yeah, he never played here. And then I did this long database search on the Cowboys and people invited to camp. He was never in camp with the Cowboys. He was never with the Dallas Cowboys. So you have a guy who, for his own ego or whatever, is bragging to a bunch of 9-year-old kids about his time playing with the Dallas Cowboys.
Unbelievable. All right. You said sixth grade son, freshman daughter. What are their names and what are the exact ages right now?
Well, my daughter, Casey, is she's 14.
Okay.
She's a water polo player. And then my son, Emmett, is 11 and he's in sixth grade.
Okay. And Emmett, I think it was Emmett, right? You had a picture of him at an Angels game this week that you posted. He's wearing a Flacco jersey. What's the connection there?
There's actually none. So my my son, one thing I've done with my son that I just love, it's kind of, I'm living vicariously through him. He only wears jerseys. So he wears a jersey literally every school day. And we buy them on eBay we will not spend more than, I think, $10 on a jersey. So he has the most random He has like a Matt Cassel Kansas City Chiefs jersey. He has a Brian Westbrook Eagles jersey. He has a Curtis Martin Jets jersey, a Plaxico Burress Giants jersey. So it's all these random guys, because the goal was to get every team. And the only team he hasn't had a jersey of is the Patriots, because he hates the Patriots so much. But so that's it. And there was, we can't spend more than $10 on a jersey. Usually I'd say average price, we pay $5 per jersey.
Why does he hate the Patriots so much?
You know, he grew up in New York. He's a Giants fan, and he associates the Patriots. He hates Brady, you know, like a lot of kids, for no good reason, but he hates Brady. He said, I'm only allowed to get him a Patriots jersey if it's like a throwback, like Steve Grogan 1980s Patriots jersey. Otherwise, he won't touch it.
It's amazing that he even knows about Steve Grogan. That's incredible. So, all right, they do still participate in sports. Travel ball in general, and did they participate that in that? But more really of a general question, is travel ball just a bad idea, or do you think there is a good way to do it?
So my son has not done travel ball, and my daughter, she's a high schooler now, and water polo doesn't really have, you know, travel ball. She plays high school, so they travel just for the sport. I mean, look, if your kid loves baseball, or just we'll use baseball as an example, if your kid loves baseball and lives for baseball, I don't really have a problem with this idea of sort of all in and you're really into it and blah, blah, blah. What I don't like a lot of times is you see the stripping down of the local leagues to such a level that, you know, what I really don't like is you'll have kids play in the local league, the town rec league, but their travel ball schedule only allows them, you know, to play half the games, or they show up late to practices, or they don't come to practices at all. And the coaches, the kid who plays all the time, the kid who comes all the time to every practice, but isn't as good as those kids, you're still going to shove them in right field and bat them 12th. And the kid who comes to a quarter of the practices and shows up late for the game, you immediately insert them at shortstop and blah, blah, blah. And like, again, I have no problem with like playing to win. I think that's fair. I think there's good lessons in that. But like, I think you also need to reward the kid who shows up and is there and is committed. And I just see that all the time, where travel ball takes away from the local league, but we still reward the kids the same way, just because they're really great.
You know, you've done so much writing about the pros and spent time talking to different professionals. Did you ever notice a common thread about the way those guys were handled as sports kids?
Well, it certainly depends on the era. I mean, I feel like, so I'm 46, and I feel like the athletes, my contemporaries, grew up playing multiple sports. You know, they did. They would play whatever the season was. So I'm playing baseball in the spring, and then I'm playing football in the fall and basketball. A guy like Brett Favre, who I obviously wrote his biography, is kind of an interesting example. Like, Brett Favre just went outside and played whatever. And he ran around and he just played whatever sport was in season. And I did a piece earlier this year, or I guess late last year, on Sam Darnold for Bleacher Report.
Yep.
And Sam Darnold is the rare modern athlete who also was raised that way. He was playing multiple sports. He was in the street in front of his house shooting hoops. And I feel like nowadays he's an anomaly, that the majority of athletes are raised in these, with travel ball, single sports, hyper-focus on one sport. And I think what's actually interesting, when you go into major league clubhouses now or locker rooms of different sports, the athletes are more boring. Like, they're not as interesting. They're not as well-rounded. They're not as well-versed. I think, yeah, you're going to make really good athletes in single sports. I think they're going to be kind of bored human beings. I do. I really do. I'm not just making that up. I think you see a lot of guys who are just less well-rounded, both athletically and as human beings.
It's interesting also that you bring up Darnold, because there's some sort of thread between him and Favre. They look the same when they run around behind the pocket. They've been compared to one another. And there is almost sort of a freedom they play with that at times can be maybe reckless in the box score or whatnot. Is maybe their upbringing the reason why there's a common thread there?
I don't know. I mean, the thing I met, like when I was sitting with Darnold's parents, he actually grew up not that far away from where I live. And I went to his house and I was talking with his parents. And they were all saying, and Sam was saying it too, like, he played a lot of basketball growing up. And there's something valuable about standing on a free throw line with 8 seconds left and your team down by one. He said there's something valuable about driving down the lane with a guy to your left and a guy slashing to your right and a defender in your way, and you have to make this quick decision what to do with the ball. You know, like, he just felt like having the different sort of experiences in the different sports gave him a mental dexterity that maybe he wouldn't have had otherwise. And I think Favre would say the same thing. You know, again, Favre grew up in his backyard with a ball of freaking tape, you know, throwing it around with his brothers. Like, there is something to be said for trying different things and having the experiences and even the muscle memories, different sort of things that aren't just, I mean, what you see with a lot of guys now, especially quarterbacks, they have their private quarterback tutor. Then they go to the quarterback camp in the summer. They're doing the same things over and over and over and over again, the same exercises over and over and over again. And while that helps in certain ways, obviously, I think when it comes to the diversity of experiences, I don't think it does you that much good.
It's interesting about Darnold too. I mean, at least it seems, and you've been to his home, it seems like there's such a good, solid base there and a great family background. And I think that's rare. I always think one of the most unspoken things in sports, and those of us who talk about it, is that those athletes and that drive, it often comes from pain, it seems. And, let's take Tom Brady, for example. Seems so well-adjusted, great family background that we know of. But why so intensely competitive? Kobe Bryant, we call him a stone-cold killer. Where do you think that tends to come from in guys?
It's a good question. I mean, for a lot of guys, it comes from a need to eat. I mean, you're raised by a single mother in the projects.
Yeah.
Your drive is to eat, or you're raised in the slums in the Dominican Republic, and you're 16 years old, and you're being scouted by these teams. That's your freaking ticket out. I mean, that's the number one driver, the number one motivator by far, I think, in sports and in life, is just a need to put freaking food in your stomach and money in your pocket, and to take care of your family. I think by far that's number one. The interesting thing is neither Kobe Bryant nor Tom Brady, right, two guys you mentioned, actually had that.
Right.
Kobe Bryant was raised by an NBA player. Tom Brady was raised in, you know, suburban upper class, you know. But I do think for most guys, it's a need to eat, you know. And then for some, it's just some people have – I think we all – can say we all. Like, I always wanted to be a journalist. That was my goal in life. It was my dream, my drive, everything I worked for. And I think we all – or a lot of people have that. Maybe you had it with radio, or maybe some guy has it with accounting, you know, like my dad, my dad's dream was to open his own business. So he busted his ass to start his own business. It's not as glorious as sports. You're not doing it in front of 70,000 people, but you know, a lot of people have that drive in different avenues. You know, Kobe and Tom Brady just pick avenues that are very public.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I also think we look at athletes and their life, and it seems to not jive with family structure, right? There's traveling, there's women everywhere. Do you have any stories of players who were truly family oriented, good dads? Like who kind of stands out as well adjusted?
So here's the thing. It's kind of impossible to say, only in that you're only, you know, when I was a young writer coming up, it's Sports Illustrated. You would classify people as good guys or bad guys based on your, whatever, 4 hours with them. You know, I spend the day with Torrey Hunter. Torrey Hunter, he was so great. Or Mike Sweeney. He was so great. But you don't know. I don't know for a fact what's going on behind the scenes. You know, I always thought Ken Griffey Jr. was a fantastic dad. I mean, everywhere you'd go, you'd see him with his kids, pictures of his kids, talking about his kids, bragging about his kids. Now, for all I know, behind the scenes, he was the worst dad in the world. But I always thought he seemed like a really good father. I'm just saying, like, it's almost like a flawed way of looking at it that you realize as you get older, because you just don't know behind the scenes what goes on. And also, the truth of the matter is, these guys, they're in careers. I don't blame them for it, but they are in careers where they are not around raising their kids for most of the year. So it does kind of put a limit on how involved they are in the day-to-day of raising of their kids.
How is the culture that you've noticed different from sport to sport? You know, you've got the books on the Lakers and then the Cowboys and Walter Payton, Brett Favre, and then Bonds, Clemens, Rocker, baseball. Which sport you know, has a culture that maybe, I don't know, is set apart a little bit? Which sport has the best guys in general?
Oh, man. I mean, if you're talking about just to deal with, I think hockey has always been the sport that most journalists say, oh, the nicest guys are in hockey. And the old line was, well, you know, they're just a bunch of Canadian farm boys and they don't know any better. They're just all shucks. And hey, I always thought, for me personally, the sport I always enjoyed covering the most locker room wise was the NBA. Because I always thought the players were the smartest and the most well-informed. And I also thought they seemed to be the most empathetic and open-minded. Baseball locker rooms tend to be not very open-minded. It's not a politically correct world. It's a very, very socially conservative world. I'm still not quite sure how an openly gay baseball player would manage in a clubhouse. I think it would be a tough little road for them. But I always thought the NBA was the most open-minded and kind of embracing. And you always had some really interesting – I've always had the best discussions, not just about sport, but about life in the NBA locker rooms.
Continuing with author Jeff Perlman on Ballers with Babies, your writing comes in a lot of forms, the books we know so well. It seems like you're writing now, increasingly over the last handful of years, as you've moved through different phases of being a dad, is inspired by family and maybe, you know, not just your kids, but your own childhood. What is it about that subject that inspires you?
I mean, it's really personal. And I remember, you know, it's very funny. I remember when I was at Sports Illustrated and Steve Rushen, great writer, got married. He married Rebecca Lobo, the legendary women's basketball player.
Yeah.
And he increasingly wrote stories related to the WNBA and related to UConn women's basketball. And I remember at the time thinking a little bit, man, he's really being impacted by being married to Rebecca Lobo. I didn't really think of it good or bad. I just kind of thought of it. And it is true. When you do write about what you know and what you see. And, you know, like I wrote a column for The Athletic a few weeks ago about my daughter and what water polo has done for her. You know, my daughter was a kid. She was born. She used to suffer from seizures. She was low muscle tone. She was never an athlete. She hated sports. She wanted nothing to do with sports. We moved to Southern California. My wife and I said, you have to do something physical just to get exercise. We didn't care if it was walking every day. She wound up doing water polo, and the sport has changed her life. Truly has changed her life. And I see that in front of me. You know, I see it happening in front of me. I see this sort of beauty in sport. And, you know, I guess as a writer and as someone who's writing about sports, it's right there. And I kind of want to share that. So, you know, as you age and as you sort of mature and as you have different experiences, you no longer feel, you know, you're no longer sort of wed to just these basic narratives of so-and-so's a good pitcher or so-and-so's hot or look, here's so-and-so making a comeback. You have these really sort of impactful personal experiences through your kids and through your family. And sometimes you just want to write about them.
You know, I also think, I mean, I can relate. Obviously, I mean, you and I are about 3 years apart in age. I've got kids that are, you know, in general about the same age as yours. And I think one of the beautiful things about the time in life that we're currently at is you officially really do stop kind of caring what other people think. You know who you are. And you can see that, I think, one of the things, the reason I'm a fan of your writing, it's outspoken, it's honest, you use social media often. I wonder, though, do you ever worry about where that all goes and then the example it sets? Because when you do put it out there with honesty, that ruffles feathers sometimes. You know, there was the Stephen A. thing, for example, you and him got into it. Your comments lead to other comments sometimes. Is that something that you process or is there concern attached to that?
Yeah, I hate it. I always, there are many, many times I've hated myself after writing something on social media. Yeah, man, it's so like, the problem is like you get in your moods and you have a laptop in front of you or you have your phone in front of you. And sometimes, you know, I would never write a letter to someone without thinking about it. I would never just, I'm not a person who fires off an angry email. I'll write the email. Take a few hours to think about it, then usually change it or never send it. But there's something about Twitter and social media where you don't really have that. All right, take a minute. Don't send. Don't Jeff. Don't press that. Jeff. Don't. Ah. No. And I mean, I don't know. It was it's kind of funny. I would say it was 2 years ago now. I was at the gym and I was watching Fox News, some segment on Fox News, and I hate Fox News. And all the women, it was one guy, maybe it was Geraldo or someone, and then surrounded by four women. And all the women were wearing skirts and were super, super, super short. And I fired off some tweet. Why does Fox News always insist on having their anchors dressed like hookers? Right? Oh,
yeah.
And I send it. Now, here's the funny thing. I send it immediately. Boom. You know, this horrible backlash. I feel like a moron. I apologize. The funny thing is, like, fast forward, maybe 7 months later, there's a long profile on one of the women who was in the studio that day. But now she's no longer on Fox and she's suing them. And one of the things she's saying is that they made them all dress inappropriately.
There you go.
But it's not that I was wrong in what I wrote, technically. But it was so stupid to write and the way I said it. So, you know, yes.
See, you know what? But what you just described is great. That's what I love about it. It oozes honesty. Sure, it may be opinionated. And then sometimes, as we all know, timing, right? It can come off, it could be, you know, come off a little wobbly or whatever because time and space, and we have to process all that in this immediate form. But what I can tell when you put something out there, and I wonder what you think about the world of media now. When you put it out there, I can tell you believe it. It's a rule that I use I always say that to my listeners. If I say it, I'm not doing it to get a reaction. It may get a reaction, but I believe what I'm saying. And, you know, I mentioned Stephen A., Skip, all these guys now, media. We know many of them, they don't believe what they're saying. It's a game to get a reaction. They're very good at doing it. How do you think that's affecting the media and the world at large?
I think it's embarrassing. It bothers me. It's always bothered me. Like, I agree with you. I hate when people say, oh, you're just trying to get clicks. Like, I'm just saying what's in my head that I believe in. That's all it is, right? Like, and I guess if you retweet it, that's great. You know, but like, I'm not saying this to, like, it's not like my Twitter following is growing by some. I lose more Twitter followers than I gain on average. People just get annoyed because people are like, oh, sports writer. And then they're like, wait a second. Why is this guy tweeting about Trump 20 times a day? You know, so it doesn't really go, well for me. Skip Bayless is a great example. I mean, I don't really pay attention to Skip. I don't think I follow him on Twitter, but I know like he's very like, he got into this thing where he was like very anti LeBron and LeBron isn't the best player and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, this is a perfect example. Like that has been disproven 8,000 times over, right? LeBron isn't, right. I don't know LeBron James. I have no need to like him or not like him. He is unambiguously an all time great, brilliant player who, as we're seeing right now, is carrying a team of misfits to the brink. I mean, there's clearly an argument you made that this is the greatest basketball player who's ever lived.
Yes.
You may not agree with it, but you can make that argument. So what I really hate in modern media, and just I'll use him as an example, like admit that you're wrong on this one or admit that your opinion is there's nothing wrong with changing your mind. There's nothing wrong with your opinion changing. There's nothing wrong with you saying one day, you know what? I feel like an idiot, but yeah, I think I was wrong about that. Like, I actually feel like I get my best response to anything when I say, you know what? I admit, yeah, I was wrong. That was stupid. Even with the Fox News thing, I apologized. I said, you know, that was really stupid. I meant it. Like, that was stupid. That was a dumb thing to write. And the general reaction is, you know what? People make mistakes. At least you admit it.
Yep.
And it's weird. Even with Trump, I mean, like, it's okay. It is not a weakness. It is not a sign of weakness every now and then to admit you made a mistake or you misspoke. You don't always have to double down. If you said John McCain, you don't view John McCain as a hero. And then later on, you're like, wait a second, that was kind of dumb. There's nothing wrong with saying, you know what, that was really dumb. That was a misspoke. People would actually commend you for that. And it's the same with Skip Bayless and Stephen A. Smith. Sometimes you're allowed to just say, I screwed up. That is okay.
I think people love that. Look at the guys who have come out and said that or something along those lines in all the steroid discussions, right? Andy Pettit did it, and it's as if people will erase from their minds that it ever even happened. When you fight it, obviously, Barry Bonds, you wrote the book on a lot of this. When you fight it, that's when it only grows.
I agree. I think people want to forgive. I actually do believe that. I think generally we as humans, we want to forgive them, and we want you to ask for forgiveness, and then we feel good about ourselves by saying, yeah, it's cool, don't worry about it.
Let me switch gears. We were talking a little bit earlier. You mentioned, oh, this guy's a good guy, but you don't really know. You've chronicled so many lives on and off the field here in the sports world. And I wonder your perspective on this. Is being a huge sports star and then also being a good guy off the field to fans and spouses and kids, is it even possible? How realistic is it?
Oh, I think it's very realistic. I mean, it's like perception versus reality. I mean, if you're Mike Trout, we'll just use Mike Trout as an example. You're going to go out to dinner. You go to the Ruby Tuesdays in Anaheim. Well, you're going to be bugged by a ton of people while you're eating your pasta. And you are allowed to say no to autograph seekers. But you're allowed to. You do not have to, while you're eating, sign everybody's autograph. And inevitably, in doing that, in saying no, someone's going to write on Twitter, oh, what an asshole Mike Trout was to me. That's a can't win. You actually can't win in that regard. But you do not have to sign every autograph. You don't have to make every charitable appearance. You don't have to do all that stuff. And that does not make you a bad guy. You can still be a very good parent. You can still be an involved spouse. You can still, call in every day from the road. Like, you can still be a good guy. I hate when people think, like, when people say, like, well, you don't understand. He has to hyper-focus, so blah, blah, blah. Or you don't understand the pressures. Like, talk to a coal miner in West Virginia about pressure. Don't tell me that, like, Albert Pujols has this, unimaginable pressure, and therefore he can't do so-and-so. It's just kind of a preposterous way of thinking.
What was the reaction, got? You mentioned Pujols there. I know when he got to his 3,000th hit, you had some pretty interesting things to say about your experiences with him. What kind of reaction did you get?
Yeah, that was not great. That was not great. That's probably one I could have pulled back. I basically, every time I've dealt with Pujols over the years, or I should say it's more observational, watching him with autograph seekers, watching him with people in the clubhouse, he's kind of a jerk to people. He's not a very friendly or warm human being. And, I pointed it out. It was probably stupid. There's no real reason for it. And it didn't go over well, and I got flogged, and I thought I deserved it. So it happens. The thing is, as my wife always says to me, you don't have to state everything that enters your brain. Like, there's no law requiring you to state everything. And I think that's pretty good advice. I forget.
All of us need to just send everything through the wife first.
Yeah, exactly.
Like every guy, like you and me, I know we all have the wife that's there, going, just kind of being like, no, not that one.
Yeah, pretty good at that. Actually,
yeah.
You really need that one.
Right. You've uncovered so much over the years, and I love that kind of view of sports. It's not just the box score and the final score. And you seem like a guy that clearly absorbs stuff. So I wonder, what is you and your family's relationship with sports now?
That's a good question. We watch very little, very little. Last night, my son and I watched about 20 minutes of it. We watched much of the second half of the Celtics-Cavs. We live in Southern California, so there's a ton of sports. So my son is a sports fan, so we'll go to 10 to 15 sporting events a year, from Division III basketball to an Angels game, Dodgers game. We rarely talk sports. I mean, rarely talk sports in this house. I don't know, I drive my kids to a lot of sporting events, and I go to the sporting events and I watch. Neither my wife nor I are parents who sit there yelling. We never berate our kids for how they did in sports or anything like that. It's supposed to be fun. After every sporting event, we generally get a Slurpee afterwards at 7-Eleven. It's kind of a warm moment. But it's, I guess my general take is my kids are growing up super fast. It makes me sad. And I want them to be kids as long as possible. And neither of them are going to be professional athletes. I don't want them to be professional athletes. I just want them to enjoy their childhood as long as they can and embrace youthful enthusiasm. Because once it's over, it's over. So I just want sports to be fun for them. I want the whole thing to be fun.
What do you typically say to them when they get in the car after a game?
What kind of Slurpee are we going to get?
Yeah.
I swear to God. Well, like, all right, like, now is the flag football season, and my son is, he's on a pretty bad team, and he's probably the fourth best player out of nine. And we'll go over the game a little, but not that we don't. There's never tears. My son really doesn't care if his team wins or loses. I almost hate that a little bit. He literally gets in the car and he'll be like, "Yeah, okay. What are you doing?" You know, there's no. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to cry after games and I'd be super hard on myself. And my son, he doesn't care. He's totally indifferent to it. He wants to play, and when it's done, it's done. It's over.
All right, Jeff Perlman, author, Ballers with Babies. Let's stick to sports, home stretch. All right, some of the most interesting stuff I've read from you and heard from you is the Favre and Rodgers stuff. That dynamic when Rodgers came in, they obviously didn't like each other much. It seems like probably not still to this day. If you had to kind of pick a side or lean in a direction of what resonated with you with the way those two interacted with one another, who you pick? Who was right?
I mean, I hate to be wimpy here, but it's kind of like a matter of perspective. I would say, like, recently, you know, Ben Roethlisberger was under getting some heat because he said he wouldn't really help whoever the Steelers' new young quarterback is.
Yeah, Mason Rudolph. Yeah.
Right. And I sort of get it with Favre. Like, I get it with all athletes. Like, you're Brett Favre. This is your job. And they're bringing in the guy. They literally drafted the guy to be your replacement. Like, that's why Aaron Rodgers, you don't use a first-round draft pick on a quarterback just for kicks. Like, there's a reason he's here. So it's now your responsibility to tutor the guy who's going to take your livelihood away and take your career away. And there's a long history. I wrote Walter Payton's biography when the Bears drafted Neil Anderson to be his replacement. He really wanted nothing to do with Neil Anderson. Steve Young, Joe Montana wanted nothing to do with Steve Young. I actually think it's a pretty, if someone came along and said, "Hey, we have this guy, he's going to write books and we're going to start using him instead of you. Can you teach him everything you know?" No, I'm not doing that. Why would I do that? So I think we need to really, you know, there's a lot of the drive in pro sports is selfishness, but not in an unreasonable way. On the other hand, you know, you're Aaron Rodgers, you're 21 years old, you're drafted by the Green Bay Packers. It might be nice if the starting quarterback kind of talks to you, is decent to you, and doesn't mess with you all the time and see you as a threat. So, you know, I don't think, honestly, I'm not just saying this as a cop-out. I don't think there was a black and white sort of right or wrong. I think they both just came at it from really different perspectives.
You know, Favre just revealed that he was in rehab three different times. I'm assuming that didn't come as a surprise to you.
Well, that was in my book. Yeah. Kind of funny. People are like, "Oh, news break, blah, blah, blah." That was in my book.
Okay.
Not at all. Yeah.
You wrote the USFL book. Is the Alliance of American Football going to work?
Oh, man. I mean, if I were a betting man, I'd say no long term. I think for a football league now to work, a couple of things you need that the USFL had, actually. Number one is I think you need to be in the spring, not in the fall. Number two, I think you go into mid-major markets where the NFL is not. You know, the USFL, way before the NFL, the USFL was in Tennessee. The USFL was in Jacksonville. You know, they picked markets. San Antonio they were in. They were in Tulsa. I think if you pick San Antonio and Tulsa-esque markets and you play in the spring, and the other thing the USFL did that was really, really smart is they drafted regionally. So the Tampa Bay Bandits, their schools that they could pluck players from, you know, they had the rights to Florida, they had the rights to Florida State. So fans who are loyal to the college teams would sort of want to see their stars continue to play. And I think that those are three really smart ways of going about it. Because football is a really tough nut to crack, especially with the NFL's dominance.
Yeah, I mean, the Alliance of American Football seems to be checking some of those boxes that you're saying. I mean, they will play in the spring. For example, they're going to go to Orlando. They grab Spurrier. Spurrier's already said he's reaching out to Tebow. I don't know if that guy will play. But, I mean, I think what you just stated, I think that is the model they're going to follow.
No, I think it's smart. I still think it's really hard starting a new league. It's hard generating revenue. The one thing the USFL really did not have, I mean, a couple of things, but is patience. Like, you are going to lose money when you start a sports league. It's a guarantee you're going to lose money. So if you enter and you're aware of that, and all the owners are, you know, the investors are aware that for the first 5 years, we are not making a dime. You have a chance. Problem is, people lose patience very quickly.
All right, Magic as a player versus now Magic as an executive. What kind of things are you expecting Magic to do in rebuilding the Lakers? And you know, do you think LeBron should go there? What are your thoughts there?
I hope LeBron stays in Cleveland. I mean, I think he will come to L.A. I kind of hate the storyline. if the Lakers can get him, I mean, you take LeBron and you put him with that cast of characters they have there in L.A. now, that's a really good team. They have everything but a star in L.A. It's kind of interesting. They have a really good supporting cast of characters. I think Magic is great. I think Magic, one of his great skills is he actually listens to people. Same way he was, you know, just in the same way when he came to Lakers and he deferred to Kareem, even when he didn't really have to. I think one of his strengths is deferring to other people. You know, he listened to Jeannie Buss. He listened to Rob Pelinka. Like, he's a natural sort of leader because he doesn't have to lead all the time. I think he's strong. I think that organization, I've lived in Southern California for 4 years now. This past season, you could see a real dramatic turn in the fortunes of the Lakers. First time in a while.
Give me one athlete who you'd want to write your next book about, if you could.
I mean, the problem is, I used to think a Griffey book would be really good. I don't think it sells. But I always found Griffey Jr. I'll tell you a quick story about Griffey Jr. I always liked.
Okay.
Back when I was doing a story years and years ago, Cincinnati Reds had a pitcher named Joe Valentine for a brief period of time.
Yeah.
And he was raised by gay parents. I had no idea at the time. I was doing a feature on him. I said, oh, can I call your parents? And he said, sure. I said, what are their names? He said, like, Doris and Nancy. I was like, what? I said, Doris and Nancy. I said, whoa, were you raised by gay parents? He goes, yeah. So I started doing this story about him. And I was going around to different players. And this was early 2000s. I was going around to different players asking how they felt about, you know, gay rights. And to a man, they were all, I don't feel good about that, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. And I went up to Junior. And he goes, I don't know, my best friend is gay. I was like, really? He goes, yeah, man, I don't care. He goes, I'd be happy to have a gay team in. I could care less. And I always remember that. I know it sounds dumb, but I always remember that at a time period when people were not comfortable with it still. And Junior just being like, hey, man, my best friend is gay. I could care less. And I always found him such an interesting and unique individual. But I don't know if there'd be a market for a Junior book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, marketing-wise, baseball's kind of in a tough spot right now. And I think it goes back to something you said a handful of minutes ago. It's just the culture is a little bit older, conservative, stodgy. It doesn't seem open to allowing individuals to kind of let you know who they are.
And the games also take so long.
Yeah.
As much as I love baseball, the games take forever. And it's hard to get young fans super excited about sitting at a baseball stadium for 3 hours.
Unless they're wearing a Flacco jersey, of course, and hiding books in different locales around the stadium.
Yeah, that one.
Hey, Jeff, thank you so much for doing this. This was a great chat. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.